Get the hats and cooters, it's Quimbo time. Rev up those motor scooters, articulate wobbling. Christmas Quimbo special, that's all.
Yo, it's articulate wobbling here.
Yo, it's articulate
Yo,
wobbling.
Yo, man.
Yo, Mr. White.
Hi guys, Laura here with
Zach, which is I, which is me,
which is you.
We haven't done a podcast in a long time.
It kind of feels a bit uncomfortable in a way.
Yeah,
like I'm so used to being in front of the camera now that doing a podcast feels a bit strange.
Yeah, well, those of you who've missed us, welcome back. But I think what people need to realise is we are on multi-platforms. We are now on YouTube. So if you've been missing us podcast-wise, well, why the hell not aren't you on YouTube appreciating our reactoramas?
That have been very fun.
That have been very fun to film, edit.
They haven't been fun to edit for you. You've hated it.
Anyway, welcome back and merry ho-ho-ho, merry Christmas to all. Because by the time this is out, it'll be Christmas time. So, DB, put in some free domain jingle music. Wobble, wobble time, wobble time, wobble time of the year. We've got t-shirts you can't buy, but we're going to wear them every year. Hey, wearing mine, wearing mine, wearing mine. I mean, that's like an advert. With, like, probably the most famous non-domain free tunage.
Yeah, that was a really bad effort there, wasn't it? Like, I was just hoping I'd be able to press it and it'd be a quick, like, skip ad situation, but.
Ah, it's Christmas, everyone. By the fire, metaphorical. Roasting those chestnuts. On the make-believe fire, settling in with all the bright colours that represents Christmas.
And mince pies!
With family, with friends, from long distance, Skype calls, because it's a COVID day.
It's Zoom.
Zooms a la Zoom. Anyway, Zoom. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
And a Happy New Year.
Good tidings we bring from Articulate Warbling King and Queen. We wish you a merry ho-ho, and we're going to review some films.
And books.
And books. And just warble the fuck on. So, though it's been a while, if any of you are interested, subscribe to Articulate Warbling Podcast, where we've been doing a lot of reactoramas. So, let's get on with the actual show. Laura, what have we got going on this episode?
We have got so the now ex-virgin, being me, not the Virgin Mary, the Virgin Laura, had not previously watched, really, or liked at all, superhero movies, because they are all a pile of wank.
They are, mostly Marvel films, they're all the same.
However... I did watch, with Zach, Batman vs. Superman.
Dawn of Justice.
Followed by Suicide Squad.
Indeedy.
It
wasn't just any of it wasn't any old Batman vs. Superman. It was the Ultimate Edition.
Followed relatively swiftly by a Wonder Woman. I'm so glad that you have no tune in your head at all, because it means that we can't actually get done for the shitty version of the Wonder Woman theme.
Then
you sound like you have problems, and you're.
But I do. It's fine.
Riding a motorbike at the same time.
Like most things in my life, I'll just excuse it with I'm autistic.
It's like an autistic crazy frog situation. Exactly.
Should we strip me naked, put paint on me, and have me like ride a Wonder Woman styled like bicycle?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. And I watched Wonder Woman in preparation for our first cinema visit in a little while, where we watched Wonder Woman 1984.
WW84. So, shall we begin with... Bless you!
Why would you do that?
It's annoying, isn't it?
Fuck you.
Fuck you!
I think we should start Batman vs Superman and work our way forwards.
Okie doke.
Do you want me to go first?
No, I want you to. You're what? What compelled you to want to watch Batman vs Superman anyway? Is it because of your exposure already to the DC world through Birds of Prey and you're like, actually, I kind of dig what DC Comics and their universe represent. I like their characters. Do their characters appeal more to you than, let's say, Marvel's characters?
Honestly, you want me to answer my question honestly? Why was I compelled to watch that film? Because in true articulate warbling style, from me, I'm going to rip you a new arsehole like I always do. And it's because you didn't shut up about the fact that I'm going to love Superman.
A new genre into itself created by Laura Jane Marshall.
Superhero movies.
Super movies, like super noodles, and you just cook them up in the microwave.
You do that in the microwave? I don't. Super noodles, in the pan.
Yeah. Oh, you do it like...
The good way.
Good way, yeah.
Anyway, in true articulate warbling form, I'm going to rip you a new arsehole like I always do. And the reason why I watched it is because you wouldn't shut up about how many films I'd probably love that are superhero related, and I wanted to prove you wrong.
And did you?
Well, yes and no, because I hated Wonder Woman 1. And I'm going to call it 1 and 2 because I can't be asked to call it Wonder Woman and Wonder Woman 1984. So I'm going to go 1 and 2. I hated 1, but I really loved 2. So that is the reason why I watched Batman vs Superman. You were determined that I would love Batman. I also felt that I would probably need to watch something before the new Batman comes out, whenever that's going to be. Because if I don't, then I haven't got a fucking clue what's going on.
Well, the Batman that's coming out has nothing to do with the Ben Affleck Batman.
No, but the thing is Batman. It's the world, it's the universe, it's Batman. So yes, it's not the same thing, it's not the same story.
I think it's because I haven't shut up about Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Probably.
And you were like, I need to watch something by Zack Snyder, I need to watch Batfleck, who is, you know, very easy on the eye.
It's one of those things where it's just like, I got to a point where I just thought, well, I'm not going to get away with not watching some form of Batman, am I? So I might as well just give up and do it. Problem is, the first half we watched, I felt... a bit shit, didn't I?
Yeah.
I was really tired.
I thought it was just an indication that you fucking hated it.
No, I could not keep my eyes open. Not because it was a bad film, but I was just so tired. So we ended up turning it off and I slept for like 3 hours that night.
Yeah.
That evening before we had dinner and stuff. And then we watched the rest of it
when we came back
the next day. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't the best film I've ever seen. I felt like it was a little bit long. And the thing that I struggle with the most with superhero movies, and this is... genuinely the reason why I don't like it, is because it's just the same shit. It's the same thing, right? So you introduce the superhero, or in this case, kind of two, and there's the villain and the good guy, and the world is going to come to an end in some way, or the city's going to be at risk and whatever, and then they save the day, and there's usually a bit of love story involved in there, sort of thrown into the mix, and then, hey, guess what? They saved the day. That being said, Batman vs Superman did leave me in tears.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't as invested in that than I was in, say, Suicide Squad. But...
you're more invested in Suicide Squad?
Yeah, definitely.
Really? Why?
Do you not remember when I was taking your blood pressure and I literally couldn't even look at the machine and I was more looking at the TV?
You're more emotionally invested if you cry from a movie than you just wanting to watch it.
Yeah, but you've got to remember, I cry at things because somebody's dad died and that's because my dad died.
Oh.
Like, a man dies in a film and I'm like, ah! But it's because it's because it, like, pushes a button in me that makes me cry. And also, I cry very easily. Mm. But, yeah. Batman vs. Superman was probably... what did I say? Did I say 3 or 4? What did I say, 4?
Excuse me. 4.
4. Yeah, 4 stars. I mean, it
I'm not going to lie, the first 30 minutes, it is a slog, but once you get to the once everything has been settled and introduced and the world is fleshed out for you and there's actual consequences. And what I love about the ingenuity of Batman vs. Superman is so much is going on thematically, character-wise. Batman is almost framed as the villain, but it's all dependent upon your ideology and moral code, really. Like, you cannot completely understand where Bruce Wayne is coming from in his fear of what Superman represents. You can also see the purity and the goody-two-shoesness of Superman, of whom has this great, utter, almighty power, of whom wants to make a difference and, you know, benefit it. But a lot of people think that in the introduction of Superman, in the wake of it, there will be more normalisation of metahumans. And I just think it's a very interesting story. It's allegory, it's political commentary.
It's really fucking
hot
here. And it's
been a very entertaining superhero film, and also seeing Batman, the way I think fanboys of Batman have always wanted to see him, that physical presence and that kind of, that jadedness and that darkness inside of him. And I love Batman vs. Superman. I really didn't like the theatrical cut. I really didn't enjoy it. I think it was just a bad environment, bad audience. Second time I loved it. And I watched the Ultimate Cut, and the Ultimate Cut offers so much more, so many more layers, much, it fleshes out more of the things that were kind of skirted across in the theatrical cut's edit, so you're more emotionally invested on not just one side of it. You really didn't get Superman's side of it in the theatrical cut, so whilst you're watching the theatrical cut, you're like, yeah, Batman, kill that bitch, kill that red and blue son of a gun who's, you know, a little Boy Scout. Superman for me isn't that appealing because of this really two shoesness, but in this one there was this that people say you can't make Superman dark. Zack Snyder achieved this semi in Man of Steel, still goody two shoes. In this one, he's not too much of a goody two shoes. He's very egotistical. He's very, I am all powerful. You're the bat. You need to bury it. He is. He's a prick in this because he's got this overt awareness of his presence and how he can be viewed and shouldn't be viewed. And he does project himself as, I'm the almighty. The bat, like he says to Batman when he bounces his Batmobile off of his chest, he goes, the bat is dead, bury it. And it's like, you egotistical, this is why Batman is, you know, wants to be a deterrent for you. Like, you've got all power and you think you're in a position to make that decision.
Well, he's kind of mellowing him in a way, isn't he? Batman's like basically saying, like, nobody can be that fucking good.
And like, if you dare, like he says, and if there's another chance that something like this could happen again, we need to make absolute certainty that it won't happen again. And
I think as well that there's something about superhero movies, and I know they're not meant to be realistic, they're meant to be fantasy, but you have to bring some realism into it. And I'll go on to kind of explain a bit more what I mean when I come into Wonder Woman 1984. But you need a little bit of realism. You need a little bit of life.
Centred in actual reality, quote-unquote.
Yeah,
unquote.
But the thing is with
cause
Superman,
cause and effect scenarios.
Yeah, but with Superman, it's just so unrealistic that it's just silly. And it's almost like, I'm going to save the day and you're going to love me for it. Yeah. And I don't like that.
I completely understand that. And what is so perfect about the opening of Batman vs. Superman, you see that consequence. The innocent of people. He's up there fighting another superhuman off the belief that he's saving everyone. But actually what you're doing is causing total destruction, many, many deaths. Though your intention is good, you are not holding yourself up for, you're not holding yourself up to be, help me with the word. He's not
accountable.
And that's what Batman, Bruce Wayne, is saying. Yeah. You're going to be held accountable. You've just destroyed a whole fucking city. No matter your intentions of being good, you've destroyed a whole fucking city.
But that's the thing. As viewers, you kind of almost pop up in the world, don't you?
Mm.
And it's like, okay, so I'm in it, effectively.
Yeah.
But I think what frustrates me is it's like, I'm good, you should just love me.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, I don't, in a real world, and I know it's not meant to be real, and I get that, and I'll probably face a lot of controversy for this, because I know it's meant to be fantasy. But the thing is the fact that I can't trust someone like that. Oh, yeah, you're Superman, you save everybody's life. Mm. Okay, no worries, I'll just trust you with everything. The thing is, and this is the thing, no matter how fantastical a film is, you will always have a character that you like, but you like them because they've been through X, Y, and Z, and they've come out the other side, and they've gone, I've done this, this, and this, and you begin to trust them as a character. And the thing is with Superman, it's almost like an instant thing, like, You will trust Superman.
You're godlike, yeah.
And it's like, I don't work like... My brain, personally, doesn't work like that. And I know it's meant to be fantasy, it's blah, 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 but...
No, but you... For no, me... Don't, no, that argument can't really be made, because when you come in, it's a film. It's a film. And although it's fantasy, it's this, it's that. Yeah, but you're within still... the parameters of this universe and these rules, it's okay to, you know, expect something.
But the thing is, you still need to build trust. You don't.
Yeah, character development and stakes. And...
You don't start up a film. This is wonderful person.
Mm.
You have to go along with them for a little while.
Yeah,
that's the whole point of that establishment of the story at the beginning, isn't it? Is that you begin to trust them, you begin to understand where they're coming from, and you get a bit of a glimpse of what they were when they were little and how they've gone through tough times. Mm. That's how you trust as a human watching a film. That's how you trust characters.
I think you might need to watch Man of Steel, because that's what Man of Steel is. It gives behind Superman, but going in cold. Yeah, you get nothing from...
Yeah, it's just like, I should just love Superman.
But that's in the parameters of the world as well. And that's what Bruce Wayne doesn't like. This alien has crash-landed on our planet.
Why should we trust him?
And we're viewing him as our saviour, the deity, our personification of a god. And he's like, it don't work that way.
He's a fucking alien. You don't trust aliens.
Mm.
I'm sorry, but you don't. If you had a green ET-looking thing that came right outside the front door, knocked on the door and went, can I have a bed to stay in? You wouldn't go, yeah, sure, no worries. You'd call the fucking police, wouldn't you? Yeah. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, is I don't trust. I can't walk into a film and go, yes, we must trust Superman because he is Superman.
But that is the strength of this film. It takes in those questions that you are left leaving watching other superhero films that you feel a disconnect from. Like, there's no human stakes. There's no human relatability. It's just...
Because he's alien.
It's very cut and dry. Good guy, superhero... The
but
parameters...
that's what I don't like about it, because it's so basic and almost childish. Good guy, bad guy. It's so simple.
As there evidence in Batman vs Superman, what you're getting at is this is the film's strength, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't go for the easy point A to point B. Everyone contained, even Batman, are corrupt in a sense.
Yeah.
They're all doing wrong. And the puppet master of this film, who I think is sensational in this movie, Jesse Eisenberg, who is this unhinged, psychotic, almost multiple personality, almost autistic character.
He reminded me of how I view, although I have only seen two now films with him in it, he reminded me of a Joker-type character.
He's very ticky,
yeah,
isn't he?
He's
very
ticky.
So much is in his head, he can't really...
But it's the manipulation.
Yeah.
And that is very Joker-y for me, because it's the manipulating of other people around him, and that's exactly what... What's his name?
Which one?
Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
That's exactly... what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
He's a manipulator, and I think that's why I liked his character so much, because it reminded me of that Joker type thing. And actually, that was quite...
It's just a compelling villain. It's not a villain going... There's so much going on within this world. Lex Luthor is a businessman. In the total devastation of Metropolis, his company has come in and rebuilt it from the ground upward. Mm. But even though in that sense Superman has benefited him financially, he's still got a hard-on because he does not like that quality of power. Yeah. He's got this deep, weird, religioso obsession of... He feels so insecure in himself. He's maybe powerful, he may be rich, but he has no centrality or form. He may be rich, he may be powerful, and he thinks anyone who's up above man in general should be destroyed. But as it evolves, you see that it becomes more religioso, and the fantastical elements like with Steppenwolf and the mother boxes that are briefly introduced. Oh, there is great power out there. You just need to attain it, and you need to manipulate it, which he does with Zod's ship. He creates a monster of what he considers a monster, and a monster of himself in the form of Doomsday.
Yeah, see, the thing is, I like that that idea, not from Lex Luthor's side of things, but it actually gives a bit more weight behind Superman and the fact that he actually uses kryptonite to destroy this monster, this great big thing.
Mm.
That is...
Born of his world and Lex Luthor's obsessions.
But it brings a bit more... it gives him a bit more of a conscience. Like, not everything from that alien planet, from Krypton, is good.
Mm.
He might be. He might save the day, but actually it gave him... You can kind of see it in the eyes. It's like, oh, shit, actually... I might be good, but not everybody is. And that it almost starts to help him to understand why not everybody might like him.
Because it is a moment in the movie. He's like, I don't care. I don't want to hear it. I know I'm good. That's all.
Yeah.
And it does grow on him. He's like, I may have been the good that was born from a planet, but Zod and all of the consequences that have come. And he does. He says to Lois, like, he says, I should. Lois was talking about the bomb at the big council. He says, I couldn't see it, Lois. I couldn't see it.
Mm.
I couldn't see it because I wasn't willing to look at it. And that is really pretty much the overall spectrum of his journey. I don't want to see it. I believe in my own. I believe in my own value and worth up to such an extent that it has blinded me from the realities that people will misconstrue me. And he seems kind of blasé about it, but also then dead hostile.
Mm.
And then Batman is that pure personification of everyone's negative reactions, because Batman's in a position to do something. And there is this cocksureness about Superman that I absolutely love, because he was not aware of kryptonite until it was used against him. And that's the ingenuity and the webwork of how Luthor got hold and attained this kryptonite. But he had no intention of forming it into weapons himself. He knew that the bat would go take it and weaponize it himself. And he's a puppet master, because Lex Luthor wanted to ensure that nothing could be traced back to him, not at all.
Mm.
So it's just masterful. And there is a spectrum and a growth of him. And like you said, you see it behind his eyes. There's this awareness. This weaponization has come from my planet. It is also something that is going to destroy me. But in the process, I might have to destroy myself to make the ultimate sacrifice. And I have to accept this. And like that, also that other strange, that powerful line he says, like, nothing stays, it was along the lines of no one stays good forever, Lois. And I was just like, yeah, that's, There's so much to deep delve into, but the overall thing is, it's people don't give credit to Zack Snyder as a filmmaker or storyteller. They just think he's a visualist and an action director, that as well. But he does have a real talent with character development, morals. There's an ambiguity and layering that a lot of people are often blindsided by the big spectacle of it all. Whereas a movie like Wonder Woman 84, that it's a fine balance. Snyder does have this overt sense of, I'm going to offset everything that's come before, the stories, the ambiguity, and the themes and the central thematics with a big action sequence.
Mm.
Whereas Wonder Woman 84, it's a fine tune, and it's a fine balance where it meets that level whilst not ever distracting you from what is at the heart of it, a good, meaningful story and message for audiences. And what I love about Snyder, he's not afraid to go dark, he's not afraid to go into the psyches of these characters and to
bring out the real story, really, isn't it?
The reality, life is dark, life is twisted.
But I think that's the thing, I struggle with about the whole super movies. Fuck that. Maybe I should just call them super movies. Superhero movies is the fact that it is quite shallow. It's quite shallow.
Yeah, it is.
Because it's like, good guy, bad guy, world's going to end, so the good guy's going to save it.
And this film does have that. That film does have that. And it could easily have fallen foul of those cliches and those stereotypes.
Yeah, but there's enough behind it to not fall into that. But that's why I've never liked superhero movies, because it's good guy, bad guy, world's going to end because of bad guy, good guy saves it, there's a bit of a love story, there's a bit of an emotion bit in the middle, and then, like, there's a big action sequence where it's like, oh, I'm going to kill you.
You can be formulaic. You can be formulaic, but if you don't imbue it with a sense of realism and a centrality to relatability in characters, scenarios.
Yeah.
I feel that things have to always be a commentary upon our times, our eras, our cultures.
Yeah.
A lot of people go, well, Woody Allen specifically says, I don't like dealing with topics because it makes them. A lot of artists are like, I want to make timeless art, but if I make a piece of art that comments upon the time, it's not timeless, it's just isolated to that moment. I'm not of that belief at all. I think you need to focus on those moments, because you're speaking in that moment and commenting upon the issues, societally, socially, politically,
culturally. Chances are they're not going to change that much anyway.
And it's timeless in that sense, because you will recall it, and the timelessness of it is the reflection as conceived and created in that piece of certain art, you'll watch it and go, oh yeah, I remember the time that it's speaking upon this, that is timeless in and of itself. And I think films that are brave to talk about certain issues, which Wonder Woman 84 does, really does, about capitalism, Trump era, even though it's focused in 84, there's so many themes and relatable strands that you can hold up against us. And I think that is the strength of these types of stories, superhero movies. You take the realism and you juxtapose them in a fictional realm, and it makes it more comfortable for you instead of, you know,
dealing with the real life.
Exactly.
Stuff,
distances is itself enough that it's not thrown at you like a water balloon, like, feel it. No, we are already fucking living it. Leave me alone. Mm. But when you construct it in fictional, almost fantastical, whimsical rounds, it's more acceptable, but also it settles in your stomach better. Mm. And that is why...
It's kind of like drinking alcohol after you've eaten dinner.
Boom!
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It just sits nicer because it's not like a reality check. It is a reality check, but it's softer.
Yeah.
It's a, I'm going to gently coerce you into this reality check rather than like, come on, see it.
Yeah. And I think the tonality and the darkness, like DC Comics is, you know, it's known for Detective Comics, but it has grown as being reflected as dark comics because they are dealing with these things. And sometimes they do punch you in the head continuously, but... With that formulation process, that filter that is art, film, literature, stories in all their forms, graphic novels, comics, if you can comment upon something and it doesn't like become the full impetus and it just perfectly settles together, it's powerful fucking art. Mm. Now a lot of people go, you call it a film by Zack Snyder art. It is art. It is very compelling and it's very relatable. It goes into the deep psyches, it comments upon certain things that, you know, we may have hidden from us, and that's what makes it timeless for me, that it can focus on certain eras and times of where it's come before. That's why Star Wars and all these other films are timeless, because in so many ways it is reacting upon the certain times out of which it is made. That's why it's an aged film, that's why it's timeless. So I disagree with Woody Allen on that aspect of not wanting to talk up on central moralities of, you know, the aesthetics of life and eras and what is going on in the current day, because it just stops it from being timeless. This is what the power of these forms of films, superhero films, they offer you...
Super films.
They offer you hope, but they offer you greater hope because they are laid with inherent relatable issues. Mm. And you can only garner hope from that, from juxtaposing what is actually going on in our world and what is inherent in our world. Mm. The insidiousness of it, the corruption, the evil, the smarminess. So, yeah, Batman vs. Superman Ultimate Edition for me is a 5-star film. Everyone knows that I'm crazy for it. And I could talk about it for a whole fucking day, the ins and outs, but we're not here for that. So, you want to wrap any piece up with Batman vs. Superman? Are you on board with what I've just warbled on about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it feels a bit more basic than that because I feel that superheroes are quite immature and basic, but this one is different to what I've experienced before.
I mean, the immature factor is purely because it's not your thing. It's just not your thing. I don't think superhero stories are meant to be taken seriously, but as time has grown, they have taken on their own mythology greater than the Greek mythology, greater than... In the future, in about 100 years, people are going to talk about Batman, Superman, like we reflect upon Greek mythology now. I do believe that. And we kind of do now with our modern generation. It's just translated and offered in a different sense.
Yeah, I do get that, but it's still, for me personally, a lot of the stories are very just basic and boring for me.
Yeah.
But Batman versus Superman wasn't... as bad as what I've previously seen.
I think you undermine it, and I think you're because you don't want to offer yourself that chance to give them a chance. Of what you have now, but I think before you're so bracketed in that mind frame, it don't suit me, it's never appealed to me, I'm not even going to bother.
But
there is a lot of good stuff out there. You just need to be directed and shepherded in the right direction. Don't go into that Marvel cesspit. Go over to the DC cesspit.
That being said, I really liked Captain Marvel.
Yeah, it's colourful and flavoursome.
That's not what I liked.
It's flavourful. Thingy Bob, Brie Larson's great.
that's
the feministic side of it you really like. Mm. Yeah. I'm not discounting that, not at all. I'm just saying I didn't like it as a film because it was a mess.
Okay.
Anyway, Suicide Squad, talking about messes. What a messy, not even masterpiece. My opinion lowered watching it this time.
Did it?
Yeah.
I really liked it.
I fucking hate it.
I can see why it's messy, but I did really enjoy it. I mean, I'm not one to particularly love on care Cara Delevingne.
Oh, fuck her and her fucking slug eyebrows.
But I didn't hate her in this film.
All she did was like have a CGI body doing all the dance, weird belly dance moves for her.
But yeah, I didn't actually hate her in this film, which was very unlike me. Margot Robbie made the film for me, as did Will Smith.
Their on-screen chemistry is phenomenal. I loved it. And they worked together before on a film called Focus before this. So I think they've come from that and they've got a bond. So, yeah. You know, it shines bright.
The bit where me and Zach disagree is the fact that I really didn't like Jared Leto's...
What do we have here?
Really didn't like his...
The thing is, you've only been introduced to one variation or form of the Joker, and it is a very high fucking standard to meet. But the thing is, what Jared Leto offers in the film is the Joker that fits within that world. This Joker would not fit in the world that Todd Phillips did with Joker. Not at all. So you're kind of... I think you're placing Joaquin Phoenix's performance up above his. You need to really judge it up on the parameters and the world it's in.
Couldn't disagree more.
Also, a lot of the performance has been cut.
Couldn't disagree more.
And cut around, well, the truth is it has been cut around.
Yeah, but what I'm saying to you is I disagree with what you're saying about Todd Phillips's Joker.
I haven't said anything negative about Todd Phillips' Joker.
I'm saying you think that I think that that Joker should have fit into that world. And
no.
That's the one that I've seen.
No, I'm saying that you're coming off of that world and you're only going off of that, whereas you should really align expectations with that world.
That's
okay.
What I'm saying. What I'm saying is I didn't like his performance. I didn't think it was good acting.
Okay.
Not because of the previous Joker I've seen. I just really disliked his acting. I really disliked his performance as any form of Joker.
Yeah.
And that's not... I don't think that's got any correlation to the previous Joker that I've seen. I just really didn't like his performance.
What was it about it that you really didn't like?
I just felt that it was just really wet weekended. If you think about Margot Robbie and how much she is OTT and... I don't know how to explain it. She's just very dramatic, very extravagant.
Theatrical.
Yeah. So, for me, if Harley Quinn is supposed to be that way, then surely she's got that from the Joker. And that's kind of how they come together and work so well. But I didn't feel that at all from Jared Leto's Joker. At all. I didn't feel any form
He's
of extravagance.
A fucking hot mess.
I didn't feel that. That didn't come across to me.
The problem is his performance wasn't refined like a lot of other performances, like Heath Ledger's, Mark Hamill in the animated series, Joaquin Phoenix's. They're actors with a methodology that they've got it to a refined point before they film. A man did a study on YouTube about the separate performances, and he studied Leto's, and he said he is experimenting before the camera. And it is uneven. He says, and yes, you may excuse his performance as being schizophrenic all over the place and not knowing where he is and the type of chameleonic character adapting to his environment. He says it's still evidential that he's experimenting on camera and he hasn't refined the Joker as of yet. But then again, David Ayer, the director, has come out and he went, yeah, the truth of the matter is, he said, yeah, he was discovering his character, but with the extra 58 minutes footage I have, he came to a certain concretized place where there is a solidified form of what he is. So I understand that thing of, what are you fucking doing? What are you? What voice are you going to do? How are you going to be? But because I love Jetto? Jetto!
I think you should just call him Jetto. That's a good nickname.
Jetto is, he is a very compelling... interesting actor. Up on reflection, it's a bad performance.
Yeah, but that's what I was trying to say before. Like, it's shitty for me.
It's not a good performance.
When you think about Margot Robbie, and even watching her in Suicide Squad, watching her in Birds of Prey, she's very extravagant, and she's extravagant because she's been with the Joker.
But there's there's a humanity with her, whereas the Joker, there is no humanity in Leto's performance. He is just a crime lord madman who gets a weird kick, but you don't.
But he doesn't come across as psychotic. There isn't that, like, I'm fucked up that came across at all. He just looked like somebody that had just kind of
dress
walked
up,
in.
Dress up.
Like somebody just walked in a costume going, I'm going to play Joker today.
Yeah.
It really lacked
for
me.
That is very true.
It was a wet weekend, and that was what, I mean, there were other things that were messy. No, I know. I'm trying to...
He's a good actor. I appreciate what he tried. I do like his performance. A lot less. It's not a good performance, but I think it's because I'm so savvy and in the know to what's gone on, and what's been proffered and offered and potentialed. I'm in anticipation to see where it can go from there.
Yeah, and I do understand
that. That's why I apologise on his behalf too often. It's not that I actually think his joke is good. It's the potential is there.
But I think the thing is, and that's where we have the conversations we have, and that's why they're probably as interesting to others as they are and to us, is because you have so much loyalty, and we've had this conversation many a times, but you have loyalty because you look into and you research and you find out what's going on, and you have a lot of information that's offered to you through research. I come in on a different level, whereas I can still sit and criticise a film and judge it and have feelings about it, but I don't have the information you have. And quite honestly, a lot of the time, I don't want it because I want to judge a film on its, literally on its performance.
Yeah.
And I don't really care whether Jared Leto is still experimenting with how he's going to make the Joker out to be. As far as I'm concerned, in that film, his performance was shite. And that, for me, gives me a better basis to put my opinion on, whereas you've got a lot more information that's out there, and I don't need that for me necessarily to say.
You just go off of what you've initially just watched,
And what I've watched is a shitty performance in my eyes.
In a very shitty film.
Well, yeah, but
shittily entertaining though.
But that's the thing. Yes, it's shit. Yes, actually, was there a lot that I really loved? No. Did I really like it though? Yes. Yeah. You know?
It is a very pop culturally drenched thing, the popular music of the time, the action. Also, though the visual effects are so cartoony, it does feel like a Saturday cartoon with just a little bit more edge.
Yeah.
It's like an Adult Swim cartoon.
But I really liked it because, I mean, when we first watched it, it ended, Zach said to me, how many stars? I said, 3. The next morning, I make my coffee and I went, I want to change my answer. And he said, why? And I said, because I was sat there and I had to... You know, your alarm went off, I was taking your blood pressure. I could not take my eyes off that telly. Yeah. So as far as I'm concerned, if I can't take my eyes off that telly, it's not
you're
worthy
engaged.
Of a 3-star film.
Yeah, you're engaged.
It's worthy of far more.
I want to know what happens. Yeah. I mean, it's poppy, it's very entertaining, it's very...
It's funny in the right places.
It's funny in the right places, but it is editorially, visual effects-wise, with all of the rewrites, reshoots and... imposed things from the higher uppers. It is a hot, bloody, neon-coloured, drenched mess, but it's so compellingly... Not compelling, it's so niftily edited, and this is edited by two movie trailer people. Their thing is to sell a film to you. So, and
yeah, but you sold me all throughout.
Yeah, but it's a mess. It wasn't the film we were promised way back when the first Comic-Con trailer was released.
No, but I think that's the thing, again, about the kind of loyalty thing. It's the you know, the fandom, effectively, that fact of, you know, you were promised a film and that's not what you got. For me, I watched a film that I really knew
nothing
about.
But your opinion seems to be different when it's directed at Snyder and his Justice League, because we've had a conversation about this, and your opinion seems to differ very greatly, that you feel that it was a real deep disservice and it was cruel of what they did to him.
Yeah, in retrospect. But I didn't watch the Suicide Squad trailer to then watch this film to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
If you showed me the two trailers, then I could probably go, or the trailer and then compare it to the film, then I can probably go, yeah, fair enough, you weren't given what you were promised. Mm. But I never saw the trailer.
Yeah.
I just went in new to a film.
Yeah.
And I just watched it, and yeah. I liked it.
Yeah, okay. How many stars? Anything else you want to say?
No.
How many stars?
Four. Four.
I'm going to give it three. Entertaining.
Let's move on to...
pause it? We need to pause it, because I think I am going to shit myself. Sorry, guys.
Beep, beep.
We're back. I apologise for the crudity. the crudity that is always inherent in articulate warbling. It's not like people really want to think of me on the shitter, but oh well.
I have to think about you on the shitter most of the time. Because you're always in there.
Anyway, shall we go into Wonder Woman of Wonder Woman 1984?
Ugh.
Now, I want you to go off on this Wonder Woman. I really want to know why you don't like it. Why
it was boring as shit. It was so boring.
I think it's so popular because of the hype of the character and how much people love Gal Gadot. She was introduced in Batman v Superman. It's very interesting. First time we've seen Wonder Woman on the big screen outside of Linda Carter and other people who failed to be the character and failed for other television programmes being put on television and they cancelled, so they didn't actually come to any fruition. So Gal Gadot is the affirmative Wonder Woman.
We should hire you to do the disclaimers on the end of adverts.
Anyway, Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Boring.
Bunch of absolute poxy shit.
Boring.
Boring. First half hour was good because you get to see the background of the character, her when she was younger. It was sweet.
It really needs to be trimmed 30 minutes off of its length.
Yeah. It was cute. It was nice to see that this little girl was desperate to fight with her fellow Amazonian people and
Themyscirians.
It was lovely and it was really cool and you're like, yeah, because you know what she's going to grow up to be. You know that she is the God Killer and you know that she has got these powers that she doesn't know yet she's got, and I'm like, yeah, come on girl, and I love a bit of feminism, I'm all about the girls, and I'm like, yeah,
how are you now?
And I'm like, yeah, all right, let's go for this. And then it just lags. It's like, literally, we're on a roller coaster, right? And it ramps up and up and up and up and up and up. And you can see that drop. You can see that instant 90 degree, oh my fucking God, we're going to drop, right? And you're going up and up and up and up and up and up and up. Yeah, and it like ratchets it up and you're like, yeah. And then you get to the top. And it goes really slow.
Well, the drop is for three-year-olds. The three-year-olds are going, yeah! And the adults are like,
But, like, the drop is, like, literally as if, like, normally they just let the whole thing go, right? And it just speeds down. This was, like, a 2-mile-an-hour crawl down into the drop. And I'm like, ugh. And that was for, like, an hour of the film, man.
Yeah.
I was so bored.
It was boring. There was not much... It wasn't that compelling. It didn't really comment on anything. Though they've set it in the framework of World War One, kind of interesting in the trench sequence. But with a sprinkling of some of these action sequences, yeah, they're saving graces. But the lead up to it, it's
I mean, I love
hollow and boring. Fucking boring!
I love the fish out of water when she was in London and she was like basically like pulling her cloak away and she was practically naked underneath and everybody was staring at her because she's the most beautiful woman that anybody's ever seen because she's from this Amazonian island that doesn't really exist, but it does. It's like domed over in this protective field, so to speak. I love, love, love the relationship between Wonder Woman and Steve. Mm. It's just beautiful. I love it, absolutely love it. And I was gutted when he died, but it just wasn't enough for me. The end was good. The beginning was good. The middle was shit.
Yeah.
Shittier than the shit you just did. So, yeah.
What did I just did?
It was just rubbish. Really, really...
What, my drawing?
No, the film.
You said it's shittier than what you just did.
Yeah, the shit that you just took.
Oh, I thought you were my drawing. Shit. I thought you disrespectful bitch.
No.
Anyway.
It was just shocking. It was, yeah, rubbish. I will... Give it 2 stars.
I'll give it 2 stars. Now.
Wonder Woman 1984.
Yeah.
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 So, I was quietly optimistic for this. I was a little bit concerned because I thought, oh my God, I've literally just watched the first Wonder Woman. It was shocking. This is 150 minutes. If I'm going to be bored, I'm going to hurt myself because this is the first time we've been back to the cinema in quite a while and I'm really not looking forward to be sitting there bored, stupid. I was a little bit confused at the beginning and felt like it ruined it a little bit that they did the like the big names at the beginning as they were introducing it, because then I know that Chris Pine was coming back, and if they hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have known that.
But you saw it in the trailers.
Yeah, but I didn't really remember the trailer, because you've got to remember, I watched the trailer for 1984 before I'd watched the first one.
Oh, right.
And so once I'd watched the first one, I'd forgotten really that I'd watched the trailer. So I felt like that kind of ruined it for me a little bit. But then I suppose still it left me guessing, how is he going to come back? How is this going to be like a blast from the past situation where he's a new person but he looks exactly like Steve? Or is it going to be a situation where he's like she's thinking to her past and it's like a new sequence that he's in? Anyway.
Clever way they'd go about it.
Absolutely. Loved the going back to the childhood thing, but kind of concerned me because I thought, please don't do this again. You know, because you see her as a kid and you're like, no, please, not again, because I can't.
All that corny, boring origin shit that dragged out for far too long anyway.
And then drops again.
And I mean, the thing is, that action sequence was really good, but because it has actual relevancy, the message overall behind it, in the later half of the film.
Lies. Mm. And that's what the whole thing was all about.
Truth. Lies, truth. And being honest with yourself, and it's not about finishing in a grand spectacle, but it's being able to realise that you cut corners to get somewhere. It has
you don't win when you cut corners.
It comes full circle with what the implementation of story and narrative and themes are there.
Absolutely. The only thing I didn't like about it was the wind when they made the wish. I just felt it was a bit cheesy.
Well, look,
it's like, I'm going to make a wish and now somebody's going to blow a hairdryer in my face.
Yeah, but...
Oh, Garnier commercial.
Did you see that opening 10 minutes in the mall? That was the corniest...
Yeah, that was pretty shit.
...cheesiest, most OTT. That was the epitome of formulaic, over-the-top, outdated comic book whimsy and theatricality and stupidness I've ever seen. And guess what? I fucking loved it!
The funny thing is, I think the reason why...
It fit in thematically and stylistically, I really did.
I think the reason why I kind of liked that...
Lovely. And camp.
The reason why I liked that bit is because it was very 1984.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fitting in the time that they're supposed to be in. And
oh yeah, not just in the setting, but tonally. It was executed what you'd expect from a 1984 film.
Exactly.
And it's very clever.
That's what I'm saying.
That's why I loved it.
It actually clicked in really well. So yeah,
and it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb for the rest of the film, because the rest of the film is pretty corny, pretty cheesy, and pretty stylistically stupid. But it's probably one of the most loveliest films and most, I think, important films that should be watched over the whole of the day period. We haven't had a big Hollywood superhero film this year. We haven't. Birds of Prey can't be covered under that because it isn't a superhero film. It's a completely different thing. And at the time of when it was meant to be released, it would have been more hope out of the coming election. Like, you can tell there's a lot of allusions here towards Trump and capitalism, with the smarmy character of Maxwell Lord, and basically really rubbing dirt in the wounds of what is happening quite now, but translating it masterfully and perfectly in 1984, which... Even back then, had smarmy business characters such like of oil oligarchs. But what I really loved about it was, even though it's cheesy throughout and it stylistically juxtaposes the aesthetic of the films and the culture and the media there, it isn't really focused upon being a 1984 film. It doesn't really want to comment upon the culture. They kind of do all of that within that mall sequence. Like, okay, we're
very
in the
quickly.
80s.
Yeah.
This is the environment.
Yeah.
But tonally, though it's corny and cheesy, the emotion and the weight lent to it, and the blowing of the hair and all that, stylistically, it's in the confines of the overall style, so it was fitting. Yes, it is over the top.
Did feel a bit Garnier-like, though. Like, you know, when they're like, oh,
I truly believe that whimsicality and theatricality is a necessity. This is where I was going with it. That style of film and the theatricality and the colour and the whimsy, the whimsicality is something that is pure escapism for me. It takes you away from, you know, the realities, and that that MacGuffin of the Wishstone and how they executed it, the whole resonance of the story leading up to when it was originally meant to be made, it was meant to alleviate all tensions about politics, societally, and in the wake of COVID, and this has been pushed down, it's taken on its a whole other meaning now to people, cinema audiences. The message has kind of evolved and morphed, and it is probably lent a lot more gravitas and weight and emotion because of COVID, because of the dour mood, the deaths, the just the mess it has caused throughout the year for so many people. And it is an alleviation, and it's about trust, it's about belief, believing in yourself, being true to yourself, also caring for others, loving others, but also being willing to let go. Because of the COVID times we're in now, this film and its jollity and its jovility and its lightness and its hope, it is drenched with hope. Such,
well, that's the whole point, though, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I know. I know. It's so drenched with such hope that it going into this film, it has more resonances, and it is far more it's a more necessary film. And that's taken on a whole new life and formation onto itself due to the times it's coming out in. And I think it is the perfect film to go see, to be elevated. And its central ideas, what it says, where it's going. To be honest, when it started going to the oligarch stuff and the more political money-making things, I was sitting there going, kids are going to be bored. Kids are going to be sitting there going, what? What? Don't get it. But they, again, quickly pushed that out of the way. Like, okay, we're making our message clear here. Mm-hmm. Smarmy business. Commenting up on, like, you know, the heyday of oil oligarchs and, you know, people like that. And then as soon as they go into that whimsicality and that storyline and that MacGuffin of making wishes, I love films that are magical in the sense of making wishes, because you know that as many wishes as you make, there's a give and take.
Monkey paw,
you know, outcome of it. Loved it. I loved it. I really loved it.
That is not what you said when you first came out of the cinema, though.
No, I said it wasn't brilliant,
but it wasn't great.
It wasn't great, but it was good. Doesn't mean I didn't love it, because after I told you I loved it.
No, but you said it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great.
No, that was me leading you into a full sense of security, because you're like, you were coming out glowing. I know how impacted by this film you were. Even though you're struggling with your back pain, your jaw was literally picking up all the stray kernels of popcorn that were scattered around my feet. And what do you mean, no, not with COVID? Like, you actually happened. It's a metaphor. Your jaw was not on the floor picking up my kernels of popcorn.
I think that your instant reaction before thinking about it was probably a little more negative than it is now.
Oh, no, I came away from it because of certain issues that I'll go into, that as me, as someone who watches film not to just escape along with it, but to pick and dissect and, like, really view it on a whole multiple spectrumite way and plane of analysis, I was really hung up on some of the bad visual effects, some of the Hans Zimmer
score.
Couldn't even say it's a Hans Zimmer score, to be honest. The laziness of it all. This guy's probably got paid millions just to have his name attached to it, and he added nothing. The first 10 minutes of the score when we're in Themyscira, I loved, because it was a new score and it was a continuation of the theme. And then throughout the movie, it is just playing the hits of DC. In a way, I can look at it as a solidarity theme from Patty Jenkins. Like, this came from Zack Snyder. Maybe that's me just imbuing it with my own sense, or trying to excuse it. Or Hans Zimmer is just being the type of guy that he's become in his later career. He's lazy. He uses the same cues, the same themes. Him and his friends do a one for you, one for me thing, where they use cues and scores and different, you know, themes and motifs, and they give and take. That came out and riled me up. It really fucked me off. But like you said, I wanted to lead you into that full sense of security, like, yeah, it wasn't brilliant, it wasn't great, but it was good, and I liked it. And you're like, well, 5 stars, what are you going to give it, like, are you going to give it lower? And I was like, no, 4. I really did enjoy it, and I loved it. And looking back on it, aside from all the criticism that I can impart upon it and deconstruct it, I'm not going to lie, I came away and I was so moved by it, and I was so impacted by it, and it is such a joyous fucking film to behold and watch.
My mask was wet.
Throughout,
because it caught all the tears, and then I took it off to get a bit of drink and put it back on, and then it was cold, wet around my eyes. It was fucking horrible.
Yeah,
it was a lovely, lovely film, though. I did really enjoy it.
the love story, the inevitability.
But it's not just love, it's heartbreak. It's love.
Heartbreak.
Heartbreak. Family.
Acceptance of your lot in life. And what I loved about Maxwell Lord's character, Pedro Pascal, who is on such top form in this, he's such an underrated actor. He gives us, you can understand why smarmy businessmen get as far as he does. He is a charmer. He is quite exotically handsome. He says all the right things. He's a manipulator, but also he's hamming it up to the nines, but it works so well because these businessmen are smarmy like that.
Yep, they are indeed.
Where are you going?
Rizla.
Oh, I really loved his performance. It was really fine balanced. Also, Kristen Wiig, who is an actress I'm not very inclined to like or enjoy. I think the only films that I've seen her in where I get any semblance of smirk or appreciation performance is her comedic portrayals in Bridesmaids, which she wrote, and also Paul, where she plays a religious nutjob who then sees the light and sees Paul and gets her eye restored. Kristen Wiig was really good in this. She actually gave quite a layered performance. I just find it hilarious how by putting glasses on a relatively pretty woman and frizzing up her hair automatically makes you a loser. How fucking dare you? I wear glasses and usually have fucked up hair. Am I a loser? Yes. Laura's putting on her glasses and doing a bit of a spacky face. Hello. Mellow. Yeah. We're not taking the cut of people, generally. We're not.
Oh, you're so pretty.
And we have permission anyway, because
we wear glasses.
We wear glasses.
You're so pretty.
Who, me?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I love my glasses because they actually allow me to see colour.
Oh, really? Better.
I'm not colour blind, but it makes it so much brighter. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, whoa.
I mean, if you watched Wonder Woman 84 with them on, your tears would have come out neon coloured.
Yeah, I think they probably would. They'd be like rainbows.
Mascara. It would be like a rainbow mascara drip right down your face. Yeah, that's all I have to say about the film. I think Patty Jenkins is a very skilled filmmaker, not just in the visual elements, but catering to the essence of the story, the characters. You can tell her and Gal Gadot, who gets more beautiful in every film, you can tell they love this character, they love this world, and I'm really happy that also Patty Jenkins has finally come into herself as a director. I think that she was really struggling with the production and scope of the first one, and I think it was a little bit daunting for her. She was an independent filmmaker who's been known for one film called Monster of Charlize Theron about the serial killing lesbian couple on the road. I think it was a daunting task, but I think she has settled into her role as a big Hollywood director here. Also, it's a love story. It's a whimsical, magical parable, a fable in a sense. It's a great superhero movie. It has great messages. I think the action sequences in this one were much more engaging because it was stylistically OTT and it was fitting for the form. I think the tonality of Wonder Woman 1 was too somber, too dour, too serious. I do believe that. I think with Wonder Woman, you need a sparkle. You need that spark of hope. You need that spark of wonder. You need that wonder in colour. The saturation, the design, the execution, camera. And I think she really fell into it in herself and she like really picked herself up. Not off the ground, because she didn't get hit down at all in the release of Wonder Woman, Patty Jenkins. Everyone was like, oh my God, you're the fucking bee's knees. And then me, I'm going, it isn't that good a directed film.
Mm.
Where it works, where it doesn't.
Yeah.
But here you can tell she feels more comfortable with this tonality rather than the dour, super somber, melancholic mood. Of course it would be, because I'm not expecting a film set in World War One to be like, oh, diddly-dee, we're gonna shoot for free, gonna kill the Germans, kill each other, gonna kill diddly-dee. But even though this film has some darkness to it, there is always inherent and underlying it an aesthetical, thematical warmth, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's really hopeful. So for me, Wonder Woman, 1984...
You gave it 4 yesterday.
It's 5 now. I can change like you changed Suicide Squad.
It is a 5-star movie.
You don't want to add anything else to that?
No, it was just so wonderful. What I do want to add for people that are missing it is this.
Well, I was going to Say to DB, put this in the intro. So I'll send you the music file, or you should just get it off the Reactor Armors for free.
Just in case people missed it.
Yeah. That is no...
Because I miss it.
Well, to be honest, that is synonymous with Articulate Warbling now.
It is, but I missed it. It felt wrong.
A lot of people...
Starting this podcast, it felt wrong.
I thought you were unsettled. I could see it behind your eyes. You're like, this stuff needs to be done about this thing.
Yeah, because it was really wrong. Because I was like, that's why. I was like introducing it and I was like...
Are we going to go for a little break that no one will know for a fag and come back and finish off? So. Because a lot of people go, you forgot Justice League. I'm not talking about Justice... See what I did there, Justice League. Justice Leagues. No. I'm not talking about that
You're
film.
You're about to.
I'm not going to. I'm not talking about that film. You may be going, what about Aquaman? We haven't watched it yet, but we'll probably get onto that soon enough, which is also more thematically and stylistically in tone with Wonder Woman 1984. But what we're going to come back to is Laura has just put down in the notebook Sherlock Holmes 1 and 2 by...
Guy Ritchie.
Why did that take you so long?
I just suddenly panicked. I think because you put me on the spot, I'm like, fuck, fuck, fuck. And then when I was thinking it, I was like, oh my God, I'm wrong, I'm wrong, I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And then I thought, I can't say it on a podcast. And I thought, oh, fuck it, if I get it wrong, never mind. We'll be back. Ooh, this is cool. And we're back in 3, 2, 1.
You're back in the room with me, Zach.
Well, that leaves me, Laura.
And we will be going into the review for Sherlock Holmes and Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows.
A Game of Shadows.
Do you really want to play this game?
Sounded more Saw-like.
Well, he's got quite a sawy voice, Jared. The actor who plays him, Jared has. Jared. What was his name? Jared Moss?
I've no idea who you're talking about.
Who plays Moriarty? He's got quite a...
Oh, yeah, he has got quite a sore voice. Are
you... Do you really want to play this game? Jared Harris. So, Sherlock Holmes.
I mean... Jude Law. And... Fuck, what is his name?
Robert Downey Jr.
Thank you.
He isn't bad to look at, but he has got a weird, like... What is it? He's, like, got a weird... He's got a weird-shaped body, but do you know when babies have been fed up with milk and they've got little bloated baby things and then they're, like, toddling along? His body's shaped like that, like a bloated toddler.
Yeah. I mean, the first one I found really hard to watch. And I think it's because I've watched the TV series and... I really like Cucumber Patch. That's Benedict Cumberbatch for anybody that hasn't. Benedict Cumberbatch. Anyway, I really like the TV series.
He was your gateway into the world of Holmes.
Yeah, so I found it really, 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 really difficult to get into Downey Jr. and Jude Law when... So I'm used to Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman as the duo. The Holmes and Doctor duo.
Yeah.
And then I get thrown into this Robert Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law duo. And I'm like, because I really like them both as actors. They are lovely to watch. But, yeah, it was really boring.
You didn't like it?
I really didn't like it.
I utterly adore the first Sherlock Holmes. It was my first Guy Ritchie experience in the cinemas, and I've always been a fan of Guy Ritchie, his hypermanic camera work. And to see Guy Ritchie go from being an independent, like, gangster crime, low budget, you know,
Peter Cushing's the best Holmes ever,
orientated director, you know, certain directors make these films and they continue doing it throughout their career, and to give a budget to Guy Ritchie and go, what would you do with Sherlock Holmes? Guy Ritchie is a very intellectual, very clever man. He's sharp. He's sharp-witted. He's just got the gift of the gab with... he's got a natural inclination for dialogue, hasn't he?
He's a salesman, through and through. When you were saying he's got the gift of the gab, he's a salesman.
I mean, when he talks about his films, yes. But, I mean, when people read a Guy Ritchie script... It's like people working with Tarantino. You want to work with Guy Ritchie because you know he writes such great dialogue. He has that certain sinister, whatever you pronounce it, dialogue. So if you come across a Guy Ritchie script, an actor is salivating because an actor loves to work around such powerful, poetic, gift of the gabbery type lines to work around. So to see him get given a big property like this, and Sherlock Holmes, the man with the deerskin hat and the clay pipe and the big magnifying glass in the vein of Peter Cushing and all that, didn't float my fancy. I've never actually been a big fan of the detective stories, but what Guy Ritchie did is no, I just never liked them. I don't find them interesting at all. I think they're quite boring, dull, and dated beyond belief. There's very little humour or very little semblance of place to keep me engaged. Also, I don't have an inclination for short stories, that of which Sherlock Holmes is built up upon. Guy Ritchie brought it to a modern audience, but what happened was he had his vision. Rewatching it, I think because I've watched it so many times, when I rewatched it with you, I thought it was a bit long in the tooth, it was a bit boring, but I knew what was coming. The thing with detective stories is the mystery. Once you've watched it once, if there's nothing else set up and it's orchestration, the mystique and the breadcrumbs, if that isn't compelling enough that you want to rediscover it again and again, even though you know the initial payoff and the initial twist or the conclusion, that's why you go back to certain stories, because you see the breadcrumbs. Well, I think I kind of ate up all the breadcrumbs and it didn't...
You created your own loaf of bread, didn't you?
Yeah, I created my own loaf of bread, ate it, and the breadcrumbs that were left spread, I'm like, nah, don't care. I know what the conclusion is anyway. I was a bit like Moriarty. I was a bit like, I know how this game is going to end.
But I think the thing is because I've seen the TV show, I also knew how it was going to end. Because it's always Moriarty.
Well, I'm talking about Sherlock Holmes, right?
Yeah, but it's still Moriarty's always behind it.
He's always... in the shadows, he is the great big bad in this Sherlock Holmes universe. Everything goes back to Moriarty.
Yeah, but I think that's why I was bored in the film, because even though I hadn't seen the film, I always knew that you always know who's...
But that's funny, even though it always goes back to Moriarty, you go into the sequel knowing that it's Moriarty, and the mystique and mystery is not to do with who is it setting off these things. It's about... it's against
how you're going to do
it. How you're going to get across... how you're going to outsmart him. It's about... being a deterrence to what he's planning. So it's not a mystery, it is a against-the-clock type thing. And Sherlock Holmes won for me after many repeat watchings. It lags, it struggles, but the on-screen chemistry between Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. is so spot on.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Perfect casting. Robert Downey Jr., not the greatest of human beings, usually not the greatest of actors. As Sherlock Holmes, he's back in his Charlie Chaplin guise. He just kind of personifies all of those cliched stereotypes of Holmes in the books and the stories, and he makes it so theatrical and so almost otherworldly that it's so glorious to behold. Whereas Benedict Cumberbatch's performance is very much like that series. It's very realistic. This movie is all stylization from the most amazing score I think Hans Zimmer, outside of Inception, has done, with the theme, the orchestration, the cinematography, the action-packed styles. You see what happens with filmmakers, like you see with Christopher Nolan. There are certain motifs, certain stylistic choices and ideas and notions that you want to achieve, but you're unable to due to the limit of your budget and your limitations as a small filmmaker. So you see sprinklings of all these filmic devices, editorial styles in Snatch, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, but with a budget, Ritchie is able to really throw at the camera with the hyper-styled fight sequences, the pause and the slow motion, the calculating, getting inside his head, how he's seeing the world, and then... when you initially get into the fight, it's just over, one and done. Really, really interesting film, cinematically. Story-wise, it's very thin. But Sherlock Holmes 1, for me, is still one of my favourite Ritchie films. So I'd have to give it 4 stars. What would you give it?
3.
Okay, now on to Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, which is... I saw it in the cinema once, came away very disappointed. I just thought it was action-packed, but also at a time where I had a certain stage of my life where I'd be really into a director, and then I'd find someone else to replace that director. So if that new director came out with a new film, I wasn't hyper-attuned to what they were delivering. I was just like, oh, it's just action-packed, and it's not very Sherlock Holmesy. And I also got very hung up on a... something that wasn't apparent to me at the time, but is now. Hans Zimmer is probably one of the most laziest film composers you will ever, ever, ever witness or experience. He is fucking lazy. He is lazy. He reuses cues, motifs, and all he does is speed them up. It isn't experimental. It isn't cutesy. It's lazy. It's lazy. He feels justified enough that he made such a compelling score, that which was nominated, and then in the sequel, it's like, well, how are we going to evolve it? I'm just going to speed it up a bit and do a certain do-do-do-do-do, and that's it. Or also, I'm going to use cues from 10 other of my films. Mm-hmm. And then, is that a self-awareness on your behalf, Hans Zimmer, because you're an egoist? Or is it just because you're fucking lazy? I think it's a bit of both. I hated this film upon initial viewing. Now, it's my favourite out of both of them. I absolutely fucking loved A Game of Shadows.
Me too.
Now, why?
I was just... I mean, the reason why you didn't like it to start with is because it's action-packed. That's the reason why I loved it. Because it just gave so much more twists and turns and let's go here and let's go there and more investigating and figuring things out.
I feel like this one was... it is investigating, yes, but it's... the against-the-clock thing is what really imbues it for you, innit?
Yeah, but it's like putting things together and putting it together quickly and trying to figure it out. And then I love that...
it's drawn out in the first one, innit?
And I love that hindsight thing where you don't really know what Sherlock's actually getting into his brain to figure things out. And then at the end, he's like, well, you remember this and you remember that and you remember this and this is why that and this is how I figured out this. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's clever writing.
But that is how the TV series goes.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, that is just the way Sherlock Holmes goes.
Yeah, but the first one didn't show that at all.
It tried to, but it would have dragged it out a bit too much. I think what they were trying to do is, with the hyper-stylizations of Ritchie, they also wanted to imbue it with a sense of being quite pure and natural to the slow ponderances of the short stories and the written form, which is what... didn't click with me, engage with me. What I enjoyed out of Sherlock Holmes 1 and put up to such a peak was the inherent Guy Ritchie-isms, his semblances as a filmmaker. When it went more into Holmesian avenues, I'm like, this isn't interesting for me. It's really, this is like a TCM TV movie type thing. Not Guy Ritchie's, but when it hit certain strides, you can't deny it. It might as well have been.
Yeah, exactly.
This one is action-packed, and the sequel had... I had the issue of the sequel initially, but as I've grown up and matured and I'm able to appreciate all different filmmakers at the same time, I used to have this thing where if I'm loyal to the director, I'm only loyal to that one director in that certain time.
So you can't like any other films.
So if they come along, I don't have time to analyse your film, but as I've matured as a film and a viewer, I watched this and I was like, oh my God, this is Ritchie's. This is Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes. It's action-packed. But the things he does with the camera work and things, like I said, that he's sprinkled out through his career so far, like in Rock and Roller, with the way the camera is connected to an actor, but whilst it isn't connected to the actor and it's dislocated, like that forest escape sequence where they're shooting cannons and guns at them, the difference in of time... how you experience time sequentially, slow down time lapse, jumping in and out, that editing and just the cranking of the cannon and then you're going into the inside of the cannon and how the camera is framed. It's just so fucking Guy Ritchie that he's come before, but here, it's come to fruition. You can feel with this, and now as a maturer film viewer and a huge fan of Ritchie and his beer, love his beer.
Except for his...
Stout. I wasn't a fan of the stout, but I wouldn't put that on Gritchie. It was a collaboration with other people. Anyway, it just came to me. Why did I hate this? Because you're in a certain mind frame and you've grown up. This is the full sum of a Ritchie film. The cameras, the cinematography, the execution of an action sequence. He makes talking in this movie exciting. Usually dialogue that is very boring, Holmesian and boring... And also the compelling nature of Jared Harris as Moriarty, who is so good in this. You feel threatened by him because he is a threat, because he can go up against Sherlock Holmes. And what I love about this performance in Sherlock Holmes, we feel like Sherlock Holmes is out of his element, and that is what gives Moriarty his verve and his arrogance and his kick. And his character is of the belief that he is 10 steps ahead, and Sherlock Holmes fucks him up in so many levels by catering to that mentality and acting all, ooh, wounded poor Sherlock, when at the end it all comes together and it's like, no, Sherlock has been ahead of you since the fucking beginning.
But I think the thing
the
is...
The twists and turns of it all, it comes to a beautiful, blooming, fruition conclusion.
But I think the thing is with Moriarty is the fact that he is the only person that can be, at times, ahead of Sherlock.
Yeah.
And it brings home the fact that Sherlock isn't always that perfect person that can defeat anybody. And I think that's what makes it more exciting from a character point of view, is the fact that Moriarty's the only one that can fuck Sherlock up.
Of whom he
without
does.
Without even realising it.
He kills Irene Adler.
Yeah.
The only person that has been alluded to Sherlock Holmes having emotion towards. We know that he has a deep, almost homoerotic love for Watson and Watson does for him.
Mm.
And even though there's this homoeroticism... And there's this flirtatiousness about it, which is always hinted upon, but it's done playfully. It's not saying these characters are gay for each other. This is how strong their camaraderie and brotherhood is, that it could easily go down any avenue. You could just be very brotherly, or you could be partners.
Yeah.
Together, I think them, in the form of Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr., aesthetically, yeah, I want them two to be a gay couple.
Yeah.
I really don't like Watson's wife in these films. She is an irritant. She adds very little.
In the TV series, she's actually a manipulator and he divorces her.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, she's like a spy,
yeah,
isn't
she's nasty.
She's nasty. Yeah.
So actually, that is pulling into that. Because she is a pain in the
ass. I wonder if they, when they do the third one, which they're prepping now, sadly without Guy Ritchie, which I'm gutted about, but Dexter Fletcher... Good friends of Guy Ritchie. Very good filmmaker in his own right.
I hope he's on the phone, like, Guy, I'm struggling with this.
The
bit.
Thing is, Dexter...
Can you just give me
the thing is, Dexter is a very capable filmmaker. You like one of his films, that Scottish musical.
Oh, Sunshine on Leith.
Yeah.
I love that film.
He also directed Rocket Man, so he is a very good director.
Yeah.
Have you ever...
I hope, this is the thing, this is what I like, or dislike sometimes about directors, is they're like, right, this is my film and I'm going to do everything the way I want to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just feel like you do just need to pick up the phone and go, I know I shouldn't really be calling you about this, but what should I do?
Fletcher starred in a few of Ritchie's earliest films, their friend, him, Matthew Vaughan, they were like the trio. Guy Ritchie was at the head, he was the director. Matthew Vaughan was the producer, but he's a director in his own right now. He's done us. He's done Layer Cake, Stardust, the Kingsman films. And then Dexter Fletcher was always like the actorly friend who would appear as a cameo, but he was actually in his own right like, God, I really want to direct. And they gave him opportunities to direct.
Yeah.
They produced his film. So he's part of that trio. Mm. And if you watch a Matthew Vaughan film with the insight gleaned now, they're very similar stylistically and humour-wise, the inherent Britishness, no matter what material they translate. I think Dexter Fletcher has enough respect and unilarity between them that he would be calling them up like, Guy, how would you do this?
Yeah, I don't want to take
over
what you've
done. Yeah, I don't want to...
I want to continue it.
Then this is the good thing about Dexter Fletcher. He makes a movie and you don't go, wow, that's a Dexter Fletcher movie. He just does what was necessary of him as a director.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He also did Eddie the Eagle. I haven't seen it. I don't know if that's any good.
I've seen it, but it's
not
a long
much,
time ago.
Yeah. I do think that he would be on the phone to Guy like, oh, my God, do you want to... Well, give me a little bit of a hint here, mate. Like, And I think Guy is not that much of an egoist. He isn't at all. He's a very self-deprecating man. He takes his work seriously. But I think he came out in an interview. He went, I have so much faith in Dexter.
Mm.
He says, I don't think he'll need to be coming to me. He went. He's in his own right, being recognised for his own work. But you know they're pals, and if he needs to turn to him, and also because of the inclusion of Downey Jr., the production team, everyone behind it, they've all come back from Richie's team. Because like I said, a lot of the British units that are used, they are a family. They're tight knit. They use the same people. But I'm excited for the third one because of Dexter Fletcher's association. Would I prefer a Guy Ritchie one? Yeah, but what is happening with Guy Ritchie is Guy Ritchie is flourishing with his own original material at the moment, and I'm actually really happy that Guy Ritchie is going out getting to make his films instead of it being a franchise associated property. Instead of them going, Guy, do you want to come in and reinvent, Poirot, would you like to come in and do a...
Poirot.
Would you like to come in and do a Guy Ritchie Poirot? And it would be like, oh, can't I like do my own film? And that's what he did with The Gentleman. But that was meant to be a TV series. But due to the popularity of the film, they're now doing a follow-up TV series. And he is just churning out scripts now. And he's a big Hollywood name, but he's still very much focused on original ideas, British filmmaking. I just think that he loves...
Oh, there's two up there, look.
I think he just loves the freedom that a bigger budget gives him.
Yeah.
I really do. To go out there. His other movie, the King Arthur one, Legend of the Sword, one of the greatest sword and sandals fantasy ever, made nothing at the box office. But he imbues it with his Guy Ritchie sense. Aladdin popped and was as amazing as it was because Guy Ritchie put his translation in. But I think he's getting a bit bored of being brought on board to established properties and sprinkling his Guy Ritchie-isms. It's like, do you want to make one of my original ideas?
Mm. Yeah, he wants his own stuff out there rather than...
Yeah.
Instead of zhuzhing
it up with his sensibilities, and I think he's kind of enjoyed that now with the freedom of big budget things and the freedom of the respect of that. And that the studio still continually are behind him in producing his films. Like, even though his big Hollywood films don't make anything, they're still in the belief that he, you know... And it's a very fickle business. Aladdin, oh, you made $1 billion. You're now the hot ticket again, whereas your two last big Hollywood films made fuck all. Mm. The confidence of voice, though he's going back to his heydays of working on a lower budget, that is only a freedom bestowed onto him because of his big project. Like we've already spoken on the podcast numerous times, these people take that paycheck so they then have the freedom, much like Ben Wheatley... has readily admitted. They take these big paychecks so it enables them to make those smaller films that they in any other reality couldn't. Mm. If you become a Hollywood filmmaker, you get pigeonholed then. Guy Ritchie said, yeah, I feel like I have been pigeonholed, but I've always tried to imbue a sense of my work mentality. I always film in London. I always make sure that it's within my grounds, my stomping grounds. Mm. And I really like that because also it's helping the British film industry. Guy Ritchie's a great guy. He is really... Like what he does for everyone else and as a filmmaker. It's just, yeah. Anyway, that was me dick-sucking Guy Ritchie for about 10 minutes. Yeah, Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. The only sore point for me was Noomi Rapace, who played the foreign gypsy woman. She added nothing. She was just there because she was a hot thing up on the release of, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original trilogy.
Yeah.
She was a hot thing, a hot name, and it was just for her to be put on the poster and put in the credits. She added nothing. I bet she got paid very sweetly for just sitting there eating cake and drinking coffee, which she does in the film. Or pluck pigeon, or whatever it is they're eating. She does sweet fuck all, and she deserved better, but the film wasn't about her. The film was about Holmes and Moriarty, and it paid off. The action was superb. The twists and the turns. The rough Cockney rifleman. Yeah. Who was a bit of a Moriarty skivvy, who I hope we might see in the sequel, because he didn't get killed off, he just disappeared into the mist, so that could be a potential crossover, carryover. Also, the great big finale, we know, the falling waterfall, the conclusion to Holmes and Moriarty, or so we think. And I just loved it that he comes out of the woodwork, telling the dog to be quiet, and, you know, Watson is meant to be after Conan Doyle in a lot of ways, and he says the end, and then he just puts in a question mark, and then the boom, 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 boom. Anyway, 5 stars for Sherlock Holmes, Game of Shadows. Fucking loved it.
I would have to agree. 5 stars.
Now, what else?
That's everything as far as films are concerned.
What else? Oh, is it on the mind?
Nothing.
You wanted to review any book?
No.
Talk about anything?
I don't want to review Hunger Games till I've finished Mockingjay. And I haven't finished it yet, so I don't want to review that just yet.
Okay, well, hopefully by the time this hits your ears, your headphones, your podcast platforms, it'll be Christmas. Also, whilst we're here, I would just like to, I'd like to personally thank Dennis Cooper. It was a very great big surprise for the likes of me and Laura when we saw one of Sweat Drench Press's releases hit his Best of 2020 Best Books of the Year.
That was very exciting.
Yeah.
Very exciting indeed. And I think more so maybe for me than you, I don't know. But I think for me, when it's something that's totally new to me, it's a totally new world. And to see that something that I've put any form of effort into, really.
Which you have put a lot into Sweat Drench Press this year.
Well,
the running and function of Sweat Drench Press has been very much on your shoulders, not mine. So thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. But yeah, I think for me, because it's such a new world and it's, you know, new people and such a new thing to me, it's more of a recognition.
Final recognition, it comes to a payoff.
Fruition.
This isn't fruition. There's no... Sometimes with these things, it is non-conclusive. You don't know how the book's going to be received. You don't know if they're going to sell. It's not the impetus behind us. It's about just getting the books out there and read.
Well, yeah, but I think for me,
this
still
is the ultimate greatest goal, isn't it? Rather than seeing a lot of royalties hit our author's bank accounts.
But it's nice to see that people are selling their books. It is nice to see that they're being reviewed by people that are bigger than than what we'd expected.
Well,
and it's nice to see that it's in the top 20, the, you know, top books of 2020 of Dennis Cooper. That's huge.
Dennis Cooper, who is one of our greatest literary minds and one of the a household name in America and within the right circles. And that was for Jared Pappas Kelly's To Build a House That Never Ceased. I think that was a surprise for Jared as well, even though they had their own friendship. There is some nepotism there, isn't there, Jared? I'm joking. There is some familiarity there. But what really surprised me was I went down the list just to purview who else was on it.
Mr. Zach Ferguson?
Yeah, one of my books appeared on there. Interiors 4? Question mark. It was... It's the same emotion that I think that you felt, to be honest. It's like I do work my arse off when I do my writing in my own way. I work so hard to achieve accumulating this madness in my head and putting it out into the world. And just to see that little book be received and recognised by someone like Dennis Cooper himself, who...
And knowing he's read it as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just about knowing somebody shared a post.
I didn't even know that any of my books were on his horizon in that sense.
Yeah.
Like, even though he posted Scunnard's article about my work, and he recognised, oh, yeah, Zach's a writer. He's obviously a writer of some little note, but actually he went out his own way and brought a book of his own, book off of his own back.
Yeah.
Literally, I've had no communication with him, like, oh yeah, I've got this book.
It's not like you've messaged him. It's not like you've messaged him and said, can you review my
book? No. That was why
yeah.
it was so bloody shocking for me. But I just want to thank Dennis for not only his contributions to literature, but to the literary community, the exposure, the love, the support, the dedication, and the belief he has in all of
us
indie artists. And by being associated with Dennis Cooper, it's a big thing. It can do a big thing for you, career-wise, or getting recognised from the right people. I mean, if it was any little old Joe who lives down the end of the street and he has like 50 cats and he's like, I read this book, I love it, I'm happy it's hit your hands. But having the likes of Dennis Cooper actually recommend a read, that is of my own, and that is of a very personal...
Sorry.
Oh, you're distracting me. I don't know who these are from.
Don't worry about it. I was later, not now.
Anyway, long story short, that's what I'm saying now.
Dennis Cooper.
Yeah, you just distracted me. Just like, this is, I don't do it for the money, there's very little money, but to be recognised by someone of his standing and of his taste. And also, since, like, ever since that article was put out, those books that were showcased by Scunnard, I literally sold one copy out of that. But by this hitting the list, like, I've sold quite a few of Interiors 4, which I never imagined. Mm. I knew that there a few of them would sell every now and then, because I try and sell myself like the little dirty prostitute that I am online. it's just so heartening that I'm being recognised as an artist, and that people are viewing me as maybe more of a serious voice. I don't take myself seriously. My work is not serious, but just
no. But the fact that somebody else is taking you seriously is nice
other
feeling.
Yeah, and other people have come from it and gone, oh, this has piqued my interest.
Mm, yeah,
like, I haven't actually read anyone say, oh, that one looks shit, this one's awful. Everyone's come away going, oh, I just want to read all of them. Mm. And why not? All those people on that list are in my wish basket now, or ones I've already brought. Because it does, it piques your interest. You think someone like Dennis Cooper, who, you know, is a very busy man, what time he does give to books, you know, if he didn't believe in them, he wouldn't give me the time of day,
no, of course.
No, so I just want to say thank you to Dennis for, not just for me personally, for bringing quite a...
It's an accolade for us.
Yeah, it's an accolade for us, Sweat Drench Press, and as for me, as myself, as a struggling, starving artist, I'm not struggling, I'm not starving, but you know the metaphor.
He's just got to make a big fuss out of something.
Yeah. And I want to thank him for his contributions and his support to us small people in the indie press.
How dare you call me small? I'm huge.
Dennis has said before in multiple interviews and even on his personal blog, he says, look, if just by me extolling my positivity behind it is enough, I will do it. He says, I've been very lucky in my career that I got the contracts and the career I got out of it. Mm. He said, and if by supplying you with blurbs or praise or just showing that there's these form of books out there, because a lot of bigger names of Dennis Cooper's, they're quite snooty about independent publishers and publishing houses. They're quite, whereas Dennis is really at the heart of independent things. He runs his own imprint himself. He's very much attached to other independent presses. He's really at the heart of it, and he is part of that beating pulse of spreading that blood flow in the indie community. Not just the positivity and the exposure, but the heart of it, the essence. It's about art and it's about literature.
Mm.
I've been in a lucky position where I've been able to make a career out of it. I've earned money off of it.
Mm.
And if I can offer that to you, or as a step towards potentially doing that to you, just by having my name behind you, that's it. And it's never done in an egotistical vein.
Yeah, look at me, look at my big never, name. Ever. It's not like it's that.
Never, he's not like that at all. He's a very humble man. And he recognises that I am Dennis Cooper. And if by me being positive behind this book can help you in...
Yeah, then he'll do it.
Yeah, like... I recommend this book. If it gets into 100 hands or 2 hands, that's enough. And for me, personally, that is always going to be enough. Like I said, Derek, like, down the street with 15 dogs, like, if that's in Derek's hands, I'm happy.
Mm.
And if Derek got that book in his hands because of Dennis Cooper's recommendation, thank you.
Mm.
And just love for Dennis. Hopefully, when me and Laura go for our road trip next year, we might stop off and visit him.
Yes,
I hope so. He seems very more than happy to entertain the likes of this.
I need a parking space, though, please, bud.
So, it's been a good year. I think we're going to do a New Year's before New Year's,
probably,
to talk about the year. Really, to end
on a high
or a low, just a crescendo to what we're appreciative of the year, what's happened. How we've grown, where we're going.
We missed something.
Future plans. Oh, what?
My Hokey Pokey song.
Shall we outro on the Hokey Pokey song?
We should outro on the Hokey Pokey
song. So, it's a goodbye from me.
That's a goodbye from me.
And now, next up is the Hokey Pokey song, sung by Laura Jane.
I can't remember how it starts.
You do. You really do. Think it.
You put your willy in, you put your willy out. In, out, in, out, shake it all about. You do the hokey pokey and you turn her over. That's what it's all about.
Oi!
Whoa, hokey hokey pokey. Whoa, hokey hokey pokey.
Oh!
Whoa, hokey hokey pokey.
Oh!
Bend her over, slap her ass, come, 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 pee!
Goodbye, guys.
Bye.
This has been the Articulate Warbling Holiday Special. Thank you for joining Zach, Laura, and myself, editor DB Spitzer. You can check them out, Articulate Warbling, on the YouTube and the Facebook. And let's not forget here, Articulate Warbling on the podcast. Just Google Articulate Warbling and you'll find them. And hey, always check out my stuff, pgttcm.com, or just look for Radio Free Oleander. It's pretty much the same thing that I always do. I have a co-host now. And I'm going to leave you with my new ringtone. I think you'll love it as much as I do. Here we go. Happy holidays, everyone, and we'll see you next time. Zach and Laura decide to do something audio-based instead of visual. It's good to be back. We'll see you later.
Mm-hmm.